Better Engineering Practices with David Starr.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host, for helping you and your teams move fast, deliver quality, and run your software with confidence in Azure, all while using everything that the .NET ecosystem has to offer. And as an aside, I'm doing a lot of online user group speaking. And if you follow my Twitter account, you see the announcements of all the different groups that I've been speaking to. And if you run a .NET or Azure-related user group, I'd love to give a presentation for you if you're one who's giving them giving presentations virtually or online. Now, the sponsor of today's episode is ClearMeasure, and they make this podcast happen. They're a software architecture company that empowers .NET teams to be self-sufficient and able to deliver world-class results. So if they can help, please get in touch. And also make sure to check out the new video show, Architect Tips. Now, I have an old friend, David Starr, on the podcast with me today. And we've known each other for a long time, but he's a principal solutions architect in the Azure Industry Experiences team at Microsoft. And there he focuses on helping companies bring their solutions to Azure and the Azure Marketplace and becoming Microsoft partners. David is the founder of ElegantCode.com, and he served in numerous leadership roles over the years and has been an early and consistent advocate for agile workflow and engineering practices. And he's also a co-host of his own podcast, Azure for Executives. David, welcome to the show. How are you, sir?
It's great. It's great to be here, Jeffrey. I can't tell you how cool it is to be on the show when all I do is listen to it all the time. When I this is how it started. I told you that I went for my walks in the morning and listened to your show. So it's a real pleasure to be here.
Oh, well, great, great. You know, we've known each other for a long time, and you're doing a lot of cool stuff in Microsoft. But for listeners who haven't heard you speak or your presentation or maybe listened to your podcast, kind of back up, what's been your background and what led you to Microsoft and some of the highlights?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask that because you ask everybody. I'll try not to make this too circuitous or out. I will tell you that, like a lot of folks you've had on the show, a bunch of my friends when I was growing up had things like trash 80s and Apple IIs and Commodores. And, mm-hmm. you know, we played with those as a gateway drug into computing. And then I went off for the military for a while and came back and started school at University of Washington after I got married. So things had settled down a bit. And a couple of years into that, I realized that I was using computers to solve all these problems that I had in other classes. And my wife said to me, you know, you can major in that. You can actually, you know, go to school for computing. I had no idea. Mm-hmm. So I changed over to that. Absolutely loved it. My first job out of college was with a Paul Allen little startup called Starwave, which developed properties in the .com era of NFL, NHL, basketball. You know, in fact, I was the first person hired to build NASCAR.com.
Oh, nice.
So I got to experience a lot of different tech there. And that was my very first, you know, biting into tech in a hard way. So did that for several years before moving myself and my family to Idaho, actually, for about 15 years we lived there. And I worked for a nonprofit there for about 14 years. So I became, over the many years there, chief software architect, and ultimately took my team to an in-person Pluralsight week-long boot camp on XML and SOAP services, which I'm sure you have fond memories of too.
The early 2000s.
Yeah, that's right. Had dinner with the now CEO, I guess he was then too, Aaron Sconard, one night, and he said, you know, you should try this teaching thing. I thought, that'll never work. I shouldn't do that. But I did. So I took some vacation time off to try it, fell in love with it, and quit my day job. So I was one of the first folks who was teaching with Pluralsight in classrooms. And then I remember the day that we all met in Aaron's basement, and he said, okay, we're all going online with this Pluralsight thing. We all thought, huh, well, really? You sure about that, Aaron? And sure enough, he was. So learned a lot about focus and goals and ignoring distractions from his execution, which was masterful. Just done a great job of bringing that company online. So I got caught up in the Agile movement like so many other people for so long, like yourself. And I was involved in the Agile Alliance Conference for many years as the technical chair and the craftsmanship chair for practices. And like you, spent some time as an MVP. And then I went to Microsoft for my first stint, where I worked on Visual Studio. So if you've ever worked in Visual Studio and you've gone in and seen that little line above your functions called code lens, and you love it, right? So you don't turn it off, right? Nobody turns that off.
Why would they?
Exactly. Very Why would useful. You turn that off? It's so perfect. Anyway, that was one of the features I got to be a part of, which was really great. And from there, left to work at scrum.org for a while with Ken Schwaber, one of the guys who co-created Scrum. So did that for a little while with a focus on technology and the intersection of that with Scrum, which turned into DevOps, as we all know it today, right? That was sort of a term that got coined around that time. Gene Kim's book came out on DevOps, and we all started learning that term a little bit more. And from there, I actually left and went to become the technical learning director at GoDaddy for about 3 years as part of their Agile transformation too. They had about 1,200 engineers, and they're all shipping on a three-week cadence now, which is beautiful. And back now at Microsoft, working with partners. So that's my full circle story. I know it takes a while to tell those old man stories, but there you go.
Well, I like the listeners to hear the rundown, because then they understand who's speaking, and there's a wealth of experience behind it. It's not just, oh, my opinion is such and such. It's like, no, okay, I've seen so much that given all that, my opinion is such and such. So it's worthwhile. Fair enough. And you've been working a lot with better engineering practices, and a lot of people have heard of Agile, and of course that goes way back, but I remind everybody that just in the last 7 years, according to the survey data, we've had an explosion in the development world, and literally 50% of developers started around 7 years ago. So when we talk about something that happened in 2010, half the development industry wasn't even in the field. And so it's like, oh, it's ancient history when you go back that far. So everything's really, is still fresh. It's like, okay, yes, these things happened in the past, but there's a lot of people who are constantly looking to get better, higher productivity, higher quality, and looking for what practices yield that result. And there's a lot of things that the industry has scrambled for over time. Agile, Scrum, DevOps. When you think of the really good engineering practices today, what are those things that you're thinking about that are modern, that are fresh, that are perfectly applicable today?
Well, I start code first, right? I just can't help myself but to do that. And I think about things like what we all learned so well from patterns and practices type teams, and from patterns and practices type learning materials. Solid principles are very fundamental to how we build software. Learning patterns and knowing the applicability of using them, when to modify them, of course, things like that. I think those fundamentals really matter when you're getting started in the industry, and bringing those things on board can sometimes be a challenge because those aren't things you're going to pick up in a boot camp. Those aren't things you're going to pick up often in a CIS program or a CS program. You're just not. Right. And so learning how to code well is very different than understanding how code works. And I think that learning how to code well piece takes a few years to get under our belts. And some of us never get it, but can implement the heck out of a given algorithm, for example, but try and come along someone else behind that and read it and you're in trouble. So I think some of those very fundamental or some of those fundamentals, I should say, are a great place to focus. And I don't know if that's what you were looking for in that answer.
Yeah. Well, I know that you've done some recent presenting on having better agility through better engineering practices. What are some of the key points that you've been teaching your audiences lately?
Well, I will tell you that I have to plug something, and that is a friend of mine named Gunther Verheyen put together a book called 97 Things Every Scrum Practitioner Should Know. And he asked me for an essay to go in that book. You know, it's one of those books that's full of essays by different people. And mine was a little controversial, almost didn't make the cut, because mine said that, you know, you see people all the time talking about the difference between agile as a mindset or agile as a set of practices, right? People will say agile is not a set of practices, processes, and frameworks. Agile is a different way of thinking. It's a mindset. And I sort of assert that we can sometimes start in one place and end in another, and it can start in either place, and we can end in the middle. What I mean by that is that, sure, there's a mindset and a practices to agility, but so many DevOps practices have been brought to teams without the term agility sort of attached and latched on to them, that we can now practice agility through improving our engineering practices and not even have to worry about that word agility anymore. It's so controversial, right? And it's something that has been around since 2000, when was it signed?
2001.
The Manifesto, 2001, right?
Yeah.
So 20 years, a long time. And it's had a great run. But what I'll say is that the marriage of these ideas of, you know, is it practices first? Is it mindset first? Doesn't matter. Because if you find yourself working from either direction, you're going to find the other side eventually.
You know, I've heard some even parenting books and various things say, just start doing the behaviors, the attitude will come. And I've heard people say,
exactly,
just force your face to smile and you'll end up feeling happy. So maybe that's related.
Yeah, it's a similar deal, I think. You know, if I don't believe in this whole agile stuff because it's woo-woo and, you know, it's all about process and I don't care, fine, don't worry about it. Worry about baking in really good, solid engineering practices to your DevOps pipeline. Worry about, let me ask you this. What's the first piece of feedback you get when you're writing a piece of code as to whether or not it's correct?
Squigglies, the IDE is telling me a red line if I fat fingered something even before
I'm so proud of you. You are the first person in a long time that has said that. Yes, I agree with you, man. That's the first piece of feedback I get. And then maybe the second piece is the compiler. And maybe the next piece might be a unit test, for goodness sake, right? And then maybe a local integration test. And we can move on from there all the way out to production, right? All the way from that red squiggle all the way through to production. So I've used a talk track like that or a slide like that for 15 years, talking about what it means to incrementally improve quality of our delivery pipelines all the way from start to finish. And as we do that, we can't help but bring on board better and better engineering practices so many, you know, and you've described a lot of really great DevOps patterns in your book, which I've read. Very good stuff there. Oh, you got to throw that in there. And I just think that if people bring those practices on board, it doesn't matter what you call them, you end up with a really good system and a really good way of developing software, and ultimately a really good mindset around it.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery.
Okay, so if there's a lead engineer or architect or even a development manager, somebody who is responsible for guiding their development team, they're hearing, okay, bake in good engineering practices, do that. And I'm hearing them kind of shout at their headphones, okay, tell me what the good engineering practices are and I'll do it. Are there ones where obviously you have different architectures or whatnot, but what do you think of when you look at you work with a team? What's the minimum in your opinion of practices?
What's the minimum?
Yeah.
So I think of the minimum as getting a build on a non-development server. That's the minimum. And let's start there. If you don't have that, you've got nothing, right? Let's start with getting a build on a Jenkins server or an ADO server or whatever the case may be. GitHub Action these days, it's where we're all headed. And from there, let's take that output and put it through some exercises of some sort. Now, that may be a very different, you know, if you pointed out, it might be a manager. What are those practices? This might be step two. Right. Step one is let's just get a build. Mm-hmm. Let's get that happening. You might do that. Let's say you're using Scrum. Do that as part of a sprint. That's a technical engineering excellence thing we want to add. Next sprint, let's add getting our unit tests run. What are those? How about let's write one? Let's write a unit test. And not only should we write a unit test, but we should get it to run in that environment of build and then run it there. So now we've got a completely new world open up to us just doing continuous integration. That's something we've never had before, right? Mm-hmm. So if we just start off with continuous integration, we've gotten ourselves a long way. This will allow us to refactor in place. This will allow us to start adding features with confidence as we start learning how to add tests more appropriately, things like that. So I'm really a big advocate for those real fundamental things of let's get a build, let's get some tests in there, let's mm-hmm. grow those tests. If we have to, let's pen test stuff, meaning that you can use something like smart tests in Visual Studio. If you don't know what's going on with your code, you can kind of lock it down with those sorts of tests by pinning behavior in place. And then you can make a change on one side of your code base and watch it ripple effect and turn something red on the other side of your code base. And that'll at least give you an idea of some side effect that you've caused.
Tell us more about that pen testing. I don't think a lot of listeners know what you've been talking about there.
Well, when I think about pen testing, I think about pinning functionality in place, right? That maybe I haven't done before. I don't have a test around it necessarily. Mm-hmm. Well, I can automate building tests like that. There are tools that go and build tests around code that is not under test. Those tests aren't really that intelligent. They're not that, I shouldn't say that to the tool makers. There's a lot of thinking behind them. But they're not necessarily to enforce your business logic. They're enforcing the current state of your software. They're mm-hmm. sort of locking it down, if you will. They're saying, I've got a pile of tests, and we know this is how this software behaves under these conditions. And so when we change something, when we add a piece of behavior, when we fix a bug, Mm-hmm. We want the tests that we're adding as in that activity to pass, but we also still want all the old pin tests to pass. And if they don't, it turns out that we've made some sort of side effect error somewhere, or it may not even be an error, but we've caused some side effect somewhere that we didn't know about. Okay. Right.
And what's your favorite tool in that class? Which of those tools do you like to use?
Well, I do like the test capabilities that are inside Visual Studio. Those actually came out of a research project from a guy called I think his name was Naichi Nagi from Microsoft Research. And he had done this work where he was able to go and mine a bunch of software, because guess what? He worked at Microsoft, mm-hmm. right? But he was able to do things like see in the code patterns, this team got a new manager. This team got a manager who adhered to certain sorts of quality practices, right? This team started mm-hmm. using quality practices of a different type. This team started adding unit tests, and he could see those patterns in the code. And so that guy's work ended up becoming what we think about as those sorts of tests in Visual Studio today.
Interesting. All right. So the build tools make it pretty easy to do a very simple server-side build, like Azure DevOps services, just pointing to a solution file at a minimum. It's like, boom, okay, now we're compiling and I can save the resulting DLLs. But sure. Adding tests, there's no kind of automated tooling to add, you know, level 0, 1 and level 2 tests. So that's more of an education thing. People still have to know what different levels of testing they should even add, right?
That's absolutely true. And it's really easy to get bogged down in things when you're getting started, for sure. Getting bogged down in things like mock frameworks and stuff like that, instead of adhering to patterns that maybe don't cause us to need them as much, right?
Yeah.
Things like that.
I don't know about you, but even as old as we are, I go back to using, you know, mock or even used to use Rhino mocks and MOQ now, and it still looks like Greek. And then I go back and just use a regular hand-coded stub or hand-coded mock pattern, and it's just so much more readable. Is that just me, or what's your opinion on that?
I use MockQ. I do. And I think I've gotten used to it so yeah. much that it's just easy for me to throw an implementation out there, even of a simple stub, that I don't mind it anymore. But I hear what you're saying. I definitely do, particularly if I'm just stubbing out some service that I know isn't actually going to be called, mm-hmm. right, as part of a call on a controller, say, for example. You're absolutely right. I get it.
I guess my point is, for any of the younger developers out there who heard of these frameworks and they're maybe struggling to use it, if you're struggling to use it, don't worry about it. Just hand code the stubs and mocks and you'll be fine.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Okay. Sorry for the interruption.
No, not at all. Not at all. I don't even know what we're talking about.
Well, we're talking about different levels of tests. And, you know, I throw out the level 0, 1, and 2, which is Microsoft terminology, right? Did it originate from Microsoft or somewhere else?
I don't know, actually.
And maybe, do you guys still use those different levels? And
I don't hear those terms bandied about a lot.
Okay. I think a couple of years ago, there was the software as a service transformation of the Azure DevOps team, of going from Azure DevOps, well, it was Visual Studio Team Server to Visual mm-hmm. Studio Team Services. They had big old white paper of the transformation of the team, and they converted all of their testers to engineers, and they had all their engineers do testing.
Oh, right.
And they talked about the different levels of testing, and they labeled them, you know, 0, 1, and 2. But you know, that was probably 3 years ago at this point.
Yeah, that was around the time of my first departure from Microsoft, actually.
Okay.
So that's when that was coming on board. Now they're talking about, and I'm sure you've heard this term, shift left testing. Heard that term yet?
Yeah. Describe it for us.
Okay. It's agile. That's what that means. Well, that means that we're all going to work together on a team that is somewhat self-organizing, that has the different competencies on it that are needed to run a self-organizing team, and that everyone is responsible for quality all the way to the left, which in this metaphor is the developer, right? So we write developer tests all the way out to maybe very complex and deep integration tests that do require people who have a specialty in writing those sorts of tests, doing things like fuzz testing, et cetera, and having test professionals. So shift left simply means that we're going to take our testing efforts, we're going to move them as far left as we can.
And I'm thinking somebody's shouting out, why left? Why not shift right? My rendition is if you model your process as columns on a board, and when Agile started, it was, hey, put sticky notes on a physical whiteboard. Well, now we have these, you know, boards of columns and some sort of tool, Azure board. Of course, everybody listening to this podcast is using Azure boards. And so they model the process, and shift left is, hey, can we, instead of finding a problem, can we go upstream? Can we go left in our process to a previous stage and do something to prevent that type of problem from happening in the first place? How would you color that?
I love that question, because somebody actually brought that up to me just last week. Said, hey, Dave, have you ever thought about the fact that we could actually model around that problem in the first place? I said, oh, yeah, you're making a very good point there. If we're going to spend a little time up front thinking about the solution that we're about to build, which is never a bad idea, to take some time up front to think about what we're about to do, then certainly we should be able to predict some of the bad stuff that we might run into, right? Or some of the things that we've seen before. Arise in certain situations, and we know we don't want to experience those again. So here's how we worked around it in the past, or here's a good tool or technique to avoid that situation. So yeah, I think before we get started with one line of code, there's nothing in the world wrong with saying that we've shifted all the way that far left, right? Mm-hmm. To the design process. I have no issue with that.
Yeah. Well, even hands-on keyboard coding, in order for a developer to do the right thing, they have to have some decisions kind of made for them. Otherwise, depending on the personalities and the tendencies of that particular developer, you're going to get different stuff.
That's true. Yeah. We all code differently, right? We just do. And if that weren't true, you wouldn't be confused every time you looked at your own code. yeah, everybody's going to have their own way of testing as well, right? Mm-hmm. And of coming up with solutions to problems that they're working around or what have you. And yeah, we're all going to get bogged down in that stuff. There's no way around it, at least in current software development paradigms.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we a few minutes left here, we kind of got to testing. What are the other engineering practices that you kind of advise people to go after the build and after the testing?
Well, I do have to lay one more on, and that is, I know you love your stats, man. You love your stats, right? So I looked up a couple of things. This is from a Gartner report in February of this year.
Okay.
So I love these. 70% of IT, of the IT market, is focused on DevOps. Mm. All right. So we can clearly see DevOps is a big winner. It's working for organizations. 88% of organizations have adopted Agile with good outcomes. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Great stuff. 26% of organizations have broadly adopted test automation. What? Double take. Less. What does that mean? Right?
That's not enough.
If I'm doing DevOps, And I'm using agile practices in the pursuit of doing so, mm-hmm. and I'm not automating my testing, what am I doing?
Well,
I don't get it.
I mean, it's subjective. We've had good results. That means we used to ship every quarter. Now we can get a new release every month. But
right.
But there's teams that have proven that you can think about some reasonable, you know, small targeted change in the morning, and you can have that in production in the afternoon. I mean, lots of teams now are doing it, but they're not doing it unless they automate their testing. It's just too risky.
Yeah. We can shake hands on that one. You asked me about some other things that I think about. I think about continuous collaboration. I think about this actually under the umbrella of sort of, you may have heard this, the tools set the rules.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning whatever tools I choose are going to dictate my behaviors. And we're seeing more and more agile practices and DevOps practices being brought into our core tooling, like VS Code, like Visual Studio. Mm-hmm. Visual Studio has that live share feature where I can essentially pair program with another person, two mm-hmm. people on a keyboard.
Yeah.
Right. Sure, you can do it over Teams, but it's not two people on a keyboard like it is with pairing. Right. So we get something like that. GitHub is building GitHub Actions, right? That everybody knows that's coming along. It's turning out to be a very powerful set of tools mm-hmm. for a lot of different types of software being built. So I think about those sorts of tools, those back-end build tools and build automation tools. And I know this one seems a little counterintuitive maybe, but branching and merging strategies, branching structures,
mm-hmm.
how do they reflect your organization? I did a lot of consulting when I was ALM MVP, and people would ask me all the time, well, how should we set up our branching? Well, tell me about your organization. Mm-hmm. What do you mean, tell me about your organization? You know, what has that got to do with anything? And it has everything to do with it. You can actually oftentimes see a organizational pattern inside of a branching merging structures or patterns.
Yeah.
Very interesting there. So I think about those things. And I don't see this as much from the Microsoft vendors yet. I'd like to see more and more things out there, like a product called Sonar Cube.
Yep.
Static analysis testing. And gives us insights into patterns and in some cases even behaviors
mm-hmm.
of the software that we write very quickly. Quick iterations of every time we do commits or make PRs or whatever it is, we're not commits, but every time we submit a PR, or every time we do a push, whatever it is we're doing, making those sorts of things part of our build pipeline, static analysis tools that give me good visualizations into my software. And I think seeing those things built into my DevOps pipelines really is what ends up getting us from technical practices to culture, right? Sure, we've got these technical practices now, and they're running really well for us, and we're making great software. And you know what? That just became the culture of our team. Mm-hmm. And you know what that is? That's agile.
Yeah. And there's not an infinite number of practices. And I think just that rundown, if people are hearing, okay, I've got 80% of those, maybe a few more. And you know what? Start feeling good about what you're doing. You'll see the results, in my opinion, if the team is, well, I helped out one client and the CEO was just asking, it's like, how do I even know? I don't even know the practices that the team are, non-technical CEO. And I said, well, when's the last time that you had a production release where there was a showstopper problem and business was disrupted after they, deployed some new code to production? And of course, at the beginning of engagement, he said, yesterday. And I said, I said, okay, well, the first step is, have your first production deployment that doesn't have a business disruption. That's your mark of progress. And then as you go along, say, okay, how long since we've had a business disruption? Because he's looking, okay, I need features to get out, right? I need new capabilities. But you only need new capabilities with business stability, right?
I love that. It's almost like a sign you see on a construction site, 88 days since our last accident,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. I mean, those are the non-technical signs.
That's perfect. That's a great place to start.
Yeah. I mean, if every time the developers push something into production, the system goes down or a feature that used to work stops working, well, then the business users are going to stop asking for things. They're like, just don't touch it. I'll work with what I have. Just don't break it. Whereas if they're used to the system not breaking, Well, then they start asking for new things because they have confidence that the team can actually keep this current system working while giving them something new.
Well, that's an excellent point. Yeah. And I've seen that in action as teams move through a maturity, if you will, of starting from a place where you pointed out, you know, yesterday we broke our production system, move in their maturity of both processes and of tooling and all that good stuff and their capabilities of writing software, then you start to expect more and more out of that team, even with the same number of people on it. Right. And one thing I feel compelled to point out, Scrum as an example, the Agile Manifesto as another, none of these things say you have to be a good software developer.
Yeah.
None of them say you have to be good at your craft. And what we're saying, I think, between the two of us at least, is, you know, that's just simply not enough. You got to do better than that.
Well, none of them say that you have to have the latest sexy fad architecture either. I mean, you could have the most boring architecture of a software system, but if people are using it to get their jobs done, it's good software.
We're seeing a lot of posts about the attributes of monoliths coming back recently. I don't know if you've noticed that.
Well, I've seen the horror stories of people that have gone microservices way too long and have really done some damage. Every new thing, if people take it to a far extreme and the pendulum swings one way and then it comes back and then we realize, oh, wait a minute, hold on. We started down this pendulum swing because a lot of us were making software systems that were too large. They were too hard to change, too hard to manage. And so we said, let's break them up. But that didn't mean break them up into 1,000 pieces.
Right. Maybe just break them up into a few pieces. Microservices got pretty discreet there, didn't they?
Yeah, the word micro led people astray, I think. Instead, it's good old software system segmentation.
Indeed, yeah.
So, well, hey, we're gonna, at the end of our time now. For people who are kind of intrigued and want to learn more, are any of your presentations recorded, or where can people go to learn more?
So, this is going to sound like a shameless plug, but
do it.
You can learn more about a lot of the things I'm talking about by going to Pluralsight and typing in my last name, Star, with two R's in the search box. And you'll come up with all my courses, many of them having to do with patterns and practices, Scrum, Agile practices, things of that nature. Even got one out there about how to use Scrum with your family. So you'll love it.
Oh, nice. Nice.
And other than that, I'm on Twitter at Elegant Coder. And elegantcode.com is the blog. Take a look at that right there inconsistently. Mm-hmm. And hopefully I'll get to know you.
Awesome. Yeah, you've got, what, over a dozen Pluralsight courses alone, looks like?
Oh, yeah.
So, awesome. We'll include those links in the show notes for everybody.
Thanks, man.
All right. Well, hey, David, great to catch up. And thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure.
And until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.